You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Certainly the story that we outside India get, but even the prevalent narrative within India in recent years has been one of economic success and rapid growth. Sometimes it's also mentioned as a footnote that there's rising inequality. And this is true in many countries where there's been this rapid growth, but perhaps particularly in India. So I'm going to ask Sainath if you could outline some of the main features or drivers of India's economic growth and why the benefits have accrued so unequally.
You know, if you look at the 11th plan document of the Government of India, the Planning Commission, you look at every single speech made by the Prime Minister or the Planning Commission Deputy Chief, which uses the word growth, you will find a very, very interesting thing since the 11th plan. All mention of growth comes with a word, a prefix, saying inclusive growth. They're already admitting that hundreds of millions were excluded. That's why they feel the need, every time they say growth, they say inclusive growth. Because they're very conscious of the fact that it has been and will be largely exclusionist. There is a parallel to that in China, where with the kind of inequality that you come up between interior and coast, now you have the Chinese Communist Party calling for a socialist countryside. Okay? Now the country was supposed to be, whole country was supposed to be socialist. Right? Now the Chinese Party is calling, we must rebuild a socialist countryside. It's an acknowledgement of the kind of inequalities that have come up between the coast and the rural interior. So when you're The interesting thing since 2008 is an admission that large segments of the population are not included. Otherwise, why would you need to be including them? Right? You would just say growth. The second is the concept of growth itself, which is a ridiculously stretched idea from, you know, an agglomeration of economic activity to mean all sorts of nonsense. You know, you link growth with democracy, you link growth with betterment. So what kind of growth are we talking about? What are its components? And incidentally, the way this thing is posed, I mean, how many people know that the fastest growing economy in 2003 was Afghanistan? It grew at 23% because the previous year it had been bombed into the Stone Age. If you build 10 kilometers of railway track and put up two schools, Afghanistan's GDP doubled. Okay. And much of it, by the way, was driven by the revival of opium. As again, recently, you had that kind of component in the growth. So what does this growth mean? So 23% growth, I mean, you've got to hand it to the Afghans. So, you know, we still lack the kind of skepticism we need towards what kind of growth? What are the components of that growth? Is it growth with equity? I'm saying that what we have is growth that guarantees sharpening of inequality. And then is it growth, as some people argue, with justice, which by the way doesn't satisfy me. I would argue for growth through justice. Yeah? It's not that you're having your main course and putting on a little salt and pepper on it called justice. It's that growth cannot sustain, it cannot, if it's not through, with, along with justice. That would be my thing of it. The components of this, and then of course there are governments whose only mission in life is to at each year announce higher growth numbers. That always reminds me of the American ecologist Edward Abbey, who summed it up in one brilliant line: growth for the sake of growth is the ideology of the cancer cell. That grows unlimited, 10% 1 year, 20% next year, and the third year you're gone. The components of this growth are very, very strongly rooted in, well, if you look at both India and China, you're building very strong export-dependent economies. In the case of India, huge industries of extraction, which, by the way, the industries of extraction now account for more than 60% of displacement worldwide, human displacement. And so you're looking at export dependent growth, and you're looking at a situation, if you go back in history, I don't think the issue is of labor productivity. I think it's of the gigantic amount of cheap labor that exists, right? And you're not able to meet their needs, you're not able to build their lives, you're not able to give them a future, and you talk about it as a productivity issue. Historically, Europe solved that problem by exporting that labor to the so-called New World and to the colonies. India and China don't have that option, right? Who are we going to colonize? We make a fair attempt in some ways. We're trying to do it to Ethiopia now. But I think it's going to have very, very serious negative consequences. We can discuss that. What's happening in Africa with Indian capital? So many, many things have happened in this thing of growth. And actually, at the same time, it's structured in a way where the trickle-down theory idea is very strongly embedded. In fact, Rahul Bajaj put it very clearly in 2004, the government must help the rich to help the poor. That was his statement, simple. Right? And I mean, that is your, now my own version of the trickle-down theory is lacks the sophistication of your senior economists. For me, it's simply that all the given food in a given room has to be on my table. And since my table isn't big enough to accommodate it, some of it is going to fall off and you guys get to eat. Right? That's essentially how the trickle-down theory works or does not work. And in rural India, what have you've had, this kind of growth has had many, many components. One, it's meant an incredible position of power to the corporate world. It's a corporate-led growth. Second, it's based on the idea of trickle-down, that something will reach the masses. The third is that it has, in the process of being export dependent, which has meant in agriculture, a giant shift from food crop to cash crop. Right, the classic bank fund philosophy of, why are you guys growing food? Canada and the USA grow enough food for the whole world, it's cheap. It used to be. And when the arguments were made, it used to be cheap. And you guys concentrate on growing vanilla, coffee, pepper, cotton, these sort of things that get you hard currency, and you'll develop. So it's meant a giant shift in land from food crop to cash crop. It also means that tens of millions of formerly sustenance farmers, food crop sustenance farmers, have been locked into the volatility of global prices in agricultural commodities, especially cash crop prices. Notwithstanding the fact that food crop is also in such a situation, if you look at Olivier Deschutes' reports on the subject, where 60% of all wheat traded on the major commodity markets is controlled by hedge funds and index funds in the world. Okay, so you have, so for me, it's not contradictory when you have this kind of growth. It's not contradictory to have increasing growth and increasing misery. I personally concede that every claim of success story in India is true. It's just true of a very small proportion of the population. You will find proof for your success stories somewhere in India. It's just that if you look at it in against the canvas of how many people are excluded from that success, and have to be, because there is no other way that you can go with this thing. And the nature of those shifts have also meant, say from 2001 to 2008, there's been virtually zero employment in the organized sector, any in terms of increase of employment in the organized sector. So these are all the components of the kind of growth that we have. So therefore, you're going to have inequality. And in many cases, it's not just that people still are badly off. People are a lot worse off in terms of relative inequality and also in terms of absolutes in some cases. For instance, food grain consumption. Here, you look at this very curious situation. India now, I just checked yesterday, 69 million tons surplus. It was 69 million tons even last week when I checked, but it was 80 million tons a few months ago. In August, we declared 83 million tons we had. Pakistan declares a 4.5 million ton surplus. Bangladesh says that they have reduced their imports and next year may even not import a single ton. Now here are these three countries with 80 million tons of surplus food grain and half the world's hungry. How did you manage that? That's the nature of the growth. With hundreds of millions being excluded from the growth, they don't have the purchasing power to buy that grain, which has now piled up. 80 million tons, you can build a bridge to the moon and back. Just pile up those sacks, 75 kilogram sacks, you'll go all the way to the moon. Better people than I have done the math.
Let me intervene here, because I think you're saying things that are leading into the next question. Let's talk a little bit about migration, because in the last couple of decades, during the same period that there's been this growth story that we've all read about, there's been also huge rural to urban migration, which is often put in positive terms as people moving into places where they can be more productive, where they have more opportunities. But what are our main sources of information about this migration?
You actually have
and obviously what are the social effects? What critique would you give of this story of migration as linked to economic growth?
Well, the first fact is that the 2011 census, see, the basic sources, you have two sources of information and they are both very skewed. They are operating on definitions which are dated by decades, while the reality has changed very swiftly. Secondly, the issue is not just rural to urban migration. There are huge rural to rural migrations. There are huge urban to urban migrations. There are small town to big town migrations and vice versa. There are many categories of migrants. Earlier used to have the seasonal migrants, okay? People who worked after finishing their harvest in Bihar, went to Punjab on the top of the train, because that's what they could afford, went and did the harvest in Punjab. Then you have chain and relay migrants, which is how America was built, by the way. You know, the first one member of one family from Europe comes, then others come. Now it's going on with our Sardars, okay? In Canada, for instance, that chain and relay migration. But the biggest and fastest growing category of migrations in India is none of these and is not covered by any of the definitions. It is footloose migration. A footloose migrant is someone who is moving without a clear final destination, without a calendar or a schedule. Like that seasonal migrant has a rough schedule, a rough calendar. I will come back here for this season. I'll come back here for the festival season. I'll come back here for my daughter's wedding, for the marriage season. I'll come back for that. The footloose migrant is constantly on the move. Now, if you take the definitions of the migrant, one is, you know, census looks at your place of birth and where you're enumerated. Now, that will miss all the in-between stops. I'm a migrant. I was born and brought up, and both my parents were. One came from Berhampur in Odisha, and what is now Odisha? One came from Kakinada in Andhra Pradesh. I was born and brought up in Tamil Nadu. I went on to do my higher education in Delhi, and I'm now living in Mumbai. The class factor makes all the difference in this level. Each migration I made improved my economic condition, because I moved with a certain degree of skills and resources. I already had that. I went from a degree in a very prestigious college in Loyola College in Madras, now Chennai, to JNU in Delhi, right? And then I went on to a major news agency in Mumbai. Each time I moved, it bettered my life. Therefore, a number of people from this wrongly draw the conclusion that migration means betterment, and ignore the class and caste factors involved in the migrations. Now, if you are a footloose migrant, there is no question of betterment. It's a question of staying alive. You have the Registrar General of India, that is the guy who controls the census, who writes the document of the census, the introduction to the document. he is on record in a story I've done in the Hindu saying, no machinery that we have captures short-term migration. The, you know, you can call it footloose migration, you can call it step migration. Now the census would capture me as a migrant because I was born in Tamil Nadu, I'm in Mumbai. Can it trace me across Delhi? Can it look at the different stops I've made en route? The guy coming, now the agricultural laborer or marginal farmer in Odisha, in the east, he goes 2 months to Raipur in Chhattisgarh to pull rickshaws during that season, during the tourist season there. Then he comes back and he and his entire family go to Andhra Pradesh or Vijayanagaram, where they work in the brick kilns under unbelievably exploitative conditions. Then they come back, then they go to Mumbai in the, for the construction industry. Now the other, now the earlier 43rd round of NSS had something like what, 6 months in the place where you are enumerated. This family is not going to be 6 months anywhere, not even at home. So there is no way that the fastest growing section of migrations gets covered or let alone covered, it doesn't get captured in the data. And those who are, you know, those who are not disconnected academics sitting in universities who are working on definitions of 30 years ago and field work of 25 years ago, they can't see this. Now what I do is, I'm out of the 270-300 days a year I spend in the countryside, I keep 40 to 60 days for migrants. So I go, I travel with those migrants from Ganjam to Surat in Gujarat, then I write about them on the way. Those numbers have been growing phenomenally. How many people, because we are not looking at these footloose migrations, there is no data at all on hundreds and thousands, perhaps millions, of Biharis, Odias and Bengalis who are now in Karnataka and Kerala. Go to Kerala, go to any major city in Kerala, go to the pubs, to the, you know, to the drinking places, you'll find that all the waiters increasingly are Odias. You go to the factories in Kerala, because they will work. Why are they going to Kerala? Because the wages are much better than Gujarat. And there is a thing of trade unionism where even if I don't like you, I will break the manager's head if he makes you work more than 9 hours, because you're wrecking my game, right? So there is this huge influx. None of this gets captured, but you can see it visually. There are still guys who stick to the census data and say, this is all nonsense, you can't prove a thing. There are actually millions of ways of proving it. So that's one aspect of the migrations. What does it imply? Where migrations have come down relatively, where the National Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme worked well. For a while, it worked very well in Andhra Pradesh when Y.S. Rajshekhar Reddy was chief minister and alive. It worked well. There were 2 years, 3 years when it worked well. It didn't work for the people who needed it most, but it worked for small and marginal farmers. It did not work for agricultural laborers.
Maybe I could stop you for a minute, just to make sure that everyone in the room knows what the NREGA scheme stands for. And to say that I think we're now moving into the real heart of agricultural crisis, which was the subject of our third question.
Yeah, the National Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme was the flagship of the United Progressive Alliance government, and it was in fact a centerpiece of their 2004 election manifesto. Okay. And in 2009, they even said that they would go to the cities as well with an urban employment guarantee scheme, which they have not actually done, because all the major actions of the last few months are not a single one of them is mentioned in their manifesto. They are now fulfilling the corporate agenda before the ship sinks. There is no mention in the UPA's, in the Congress party, because UPA is a post-election alliance. There is no mention in the Congress government's manifesto of anything called direct cash transfers. There's no mention of FDI in retail. None of this. This is not the Congress party's manifesto. It is the corporate manifesto. Okay? That's what's happening there. But the Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme was thought up to create, because of the incredible agrarian distress between 97 and 2004, which saw many governments defeated in the election, including the darling of the Western media and corporations, Mr. Chandrababu Naidu, Chief Minister of Andhra Pradesh, the first Chief Minister and hopefully the last in our history, who preferred to call himself the CEO of Andhra Pradesh. Well, the people fired him in 2004 and he has not a hope in hell of returning to power. Because of, and mind you, that particular thing was touted in the West as the success story. Coming back to your first question, Chandrababu Naidu, and liberally funded by every donor you care to name, you know, and DFID did incredible damage with backing Naidu at that time. In fact, one of the interesting things after he lost was that the government laid off 6,500 consultants. No other government had 6,500 consultants. Okay, but they laid off 6,000, including advertisement gurus like Alik Padamsi from Mumbai. So you have the employment guarantee scheme came amidst huge distress, but it was, I will sum it up in one line, it meant to provide a number of days of work to rural families in order to keep them from migrating, in order to bring some stability into their lives, in order to give them purchasing power by keeping a particular kind of wage level, and therefore they would be able to buy food, which had also then, just like now, piled up.
Them from committing suicide. Wasn't suicide
the NREGA and its links to suicide are a little different, but yes, it helped them in the sense, in a tenuous way, in the sense that it addressed great agrarian distress. You could make that link, but the suicide issue is complex. There are other sources. Now it came, remember that the NREGS also came for providing that work for landless agricultural laborers who were seen as a major group in distress. It has act, now how do I see the NREGS? I think very desirable, incredibly insufficient, both. Okay, they never committed enough funds to it, they never, and they also built in huge structural flaws. Two major structural flaws were 100 days per household, not per individual, per household. That meant, you know, poorer families have larger number, more members. It meant that if your family had 6-7 members, your 100 days was over in 15 days. If your family had 5 working members, your 100 days was over in 20. And what the heck were you supposed to do for the remaining 345 days? Lie down and die. So what happened is that the NREGS failed in many places where the marginalization of the peasantry or the agricultural laborers was so high that they couldn't hang around for your 20 days. So I have traveled with families which have gone and worked in Andhra Pradesh from Bolangir and Kalahandi in Odisha. They've gone and worked in Andhra Pradesh at the brick kilns under horrible conditions with obnoxious employers at half the rate of the NREGS because it gives them 200 days of work. Whereas 20, okay, second, the NREGS also built in other flaws. The nature of registration, very complex, I won't go into it, very stupid, it's broken down. That's one problem, which it was doomed from the start. But importantly, the handing out of payments under NREGS is so bad, taking months at a time, that whereas the exploitative brick kiln owner in the neighboring state, he sends his agents to your village and pays you the money for your 100 days in advance, with which you are able to conduct your daughter's wedding, with which you are able to do the necessities during the festival period. So you are getting your 15,000 rupees, 20,000 rupees in advance, and then you are working it off on his brick kiln. In NREGS, you do the work and then you wait and then you wait and then you lose a lot of money going to the headquarters to try and get your payment. That's yet another problem. So there were some structural design, there were basic design flaws in how it was done. And there was, okay, let me give you a monetary equation. Let's say there is a family amongst us here of 5 people. Nobody gets the maximum amount on NREGS. No woman has ever got 100 rupees that I know of. Okay, but it's now gone up. They've made it, if you take a national average of different states, it comes to about 132 rupees. Now in 100 days, what is the maximum you can get? Your whole family can get 132 into 100, 13,200 rupees, right? The money lender contractor for the big kiln is giving you 15,000 rupees in advance. Second, the government of India has always resisted, despite even advice from the courts, the idea that the NREGS wage should not be lower than the minimum wage of a state. They always resisted that. So these kind of, it started with these kind of, you know, baggage, and it got into serious problems from there onwards. So the NREGS desperately needed. Okay, I said one thing. It benefited small and marginal farmers more than it benefited landless agricultural laborers. The reason is obvious. A small or marginal farmer has anyway 90 days of work on his own farm. So another 100 days comes in handy. Right? But if you are landless, then you don't have that 90 days. You get onto the bus to Mumbai and start looking. Okay? So it missed out on the largest group that it was to serve. They do work on it in terms of crisis, when there's no choice, but it hasn't served them as it should.
Can you elaborate on this question of payouts? Because something that's also being talked about a lot now is the universal ID, the notion of establishing bank accounts for people as a way to eliminate corruption, and beyond the NREGS, giving other kinds of subsidies in the form of cash transfers as opposed to in the form of direct commodities.
Look, what is the... Let me concede that the government of India... The government of India's record is unquestionable when it comes to successfully transferring gigantic sums of money and resources to its ministers and to the corporate world. When it comes to trying and transferring stuff to poor people, it has an entirely different record. I am not arguing that you should never have direct cash transfers. I'm saying a lot of conditions have to be in place for that to happen successfully. Most of those conditions are not in place in India. Let's start with bank accounts. Rather than put up some economist's critique of the government, let me talk about what the Reserve Bank of India's governor says. D. Subba Rao has said in a speech that has been carried this March in EPW, but he said it in November at the BIS-CAFRAL meeting in Bombay. I quote from D. Subba Rao. He says of 600,000 habitations in India, 600,000, only 36,000 have a bank branch. I interject one sentence of my own. After the liberalization, thousands of bank branches were closed. Then after a lot of criticism, post-2010, a few were increased or reintroduced. Then they're trying to shift to another model called the business correspondent model, which is creating a new class of money lenders very effectively. So what happens is that the governor of the Reserve Bank is telling you, I quote his words, the extent of financial exclusion is staggering. You don't have the banks, you don't have the bank branches in the rural areas, you don't have accounts, and then he gives a figure. Remember how much we love boasting in India that 50% of the population, I mean, industry says 70%, it's all bullshit. The census tells you that 50% of Indians now have cell phones. The Reserve Bank of India's governor tells me 60% of Indians don't have bank accounts. Now this is the serving RBI governor, not a retired guy writing his memoirs about the 80s. The serving RBI governor tells us 60%. Now if 60% of Indians don't have bank accounts, the predominance within that 60% will be rural. If it is 60% nationwide, it's going to be 70-75% rural. Within that, farmers will be a very large category and agricultural laborers will be a very large category. What are you going to transfer? I see incredible law and order problems coming up in this. I see incredible crime ahead in this. Yeah. Now, another thing about, you know, they're going to make a highly visible exercise. They're going to put a lot of people in serious trouble. What is the government doing actually? It is a this is a cornerstone of neoliberal policy. The cash transfer, never mind, there's an election 14 months, in 2014 there will be an election, and that's what they're gearing for and trying to make a thing of it, because the underside of it they think may not show up before the election. In the election, even if I don't get the money but she has, I think, okay, my neighbor's got it, my turn will come. But all the pilot studies done, say on Kot Khasim in Rajasthan, show you that for 3 months the transfers happened and then they didn't, and there's a huge collapse in it. There's a huge, another thing, just suppose they decide to do it by other means than bank accounts, what are those means going to be? Are you going to have somebody with a cash box moving around the villages? You know, I think I'll shift to Bihar and buy a guns. Okay, how are you going to transfer that? How are you going to make the delivery of cash when 60% of your population do not have bank accounts? Now, I'm also saying it becomes very important, I said, I'm not criticizing direct cash transfers per se. Don't do it in food. Don't do it with food. Because your food subsidy is not just about giving consumers cheaper food. It's a producer subsidy as well. Okay? That's the history of the public distribution system in India. It started to serve and balance the interests of producers and consumers, and by the way, it goes back to 1920s Kerala, when the famine took place in the Malabar. It did not thing called the public distribution system, which we call today, came out of people's initiatives. It came out of people taking the initiative. Farmers and consumers got together, and those co-ops were known as producers and consumers cooperatives. Producers and consumers cooperatives. That's what they were called during the Malabar famine of the 1920s. So we have a public distribution system that was meant, did not, but is meant and was structured to balance interests of producers and consumers, and a large part, the producers and consumers are overlapping. Please understand that 77% of Indian farmers are net purchasers of food grain. They don't produce enough to feed their families. And many of them have shifted to other crops. 77% of India, all my figures are official government figures, over 70% you will find are net purchasers of food grain. So that price affects that farmer also when he goes to buy. That whole idea of a complex public system was to balance these different forces. Consumer producer and a guy who is both consumer and producer. It's very difficult for people outside of India, and obviously for 90% of Indian economists as well, to imagine a situation of a guy who is producing and consuming as well, and is not producing enough on his thing and has to go to the market to buy grain. Right? Now, you have no idea how much of the grain leaves that person's hands before any before he's got his expenses done, because he's got a prefixed price with the money lender. Okay, for that crop loan of that period. Now, you're going to send him entirely there. You're going to send him entirely there, because the whole purpose of this kind of direct cash transfer is that the government gets out of direct delivery of services and goods to the poor and tries substituting it with cash. Two things will happen. I, as the money lender, know that you're getting that cash. Okay, pay me what you owe me. I know that you've got 600 rupees in your bank account. Pay me. I know it. My brother works in the bank. I know that money has arrived for you. This is one set of complications that's going to arise. Second, what the government is doing in the process is withdrawing from procurement. And that procurement keeps that guy alive. The government is getting out of the procurement of grain, which has been central to the stability of that small peasantry. Watch what happens to the rich states of Punjab and Haryana when the PDS goes. All they will depend on later is more and more exports. By the way, in this 80 million tons came down to 69 million tons because the cabinet took a decision to export 10 million tons to Europe. Now, incidentally, imagine for a moment that of our 80 million tons, we do not have a capacity for storing more than 24 million tons. So the remaining 64 million tons is out rotting, the entire remaining 60 million tons was out rotting in the open, or in very poor storage, and where they've got themselves into incredible complexities in hiring storage space at unbelievable rental rates for the private people. So they said, now tell me, rotten grain, why would anyone in Europe buy 10 million tons of rotten grain? Rotting grain. Which European do you know who's going to eat that? I know a few. The cattle population of Europe. That's what they're being exported for. We are subsidizing these exports. The poorest people in the world are subsidizing the food of the most food secure creature on the planet, the European cow. And its close relative, the American one. One of the person I consider the outstanding agrarian intellectual of Western India, Vijay Javandia, put it brilliantly quite some time ago when the previous such instance occurred in 2004. Some eager beaver young reporter from the West stuck a mic up his nostril for television and said, Mr. Javandia, please tell me what is the dream of the Indian farmer. He said, the dream of the Indian farmer is to be born a European cow. He said that creature gets more subsidies in a month than I do in a year. $3 almost, $2.75 per cow per day was when the averages were last calculated. I have no idea what it is now. So you've got yourself into incredibly difficult situations. The direct cash transfers, so you know, if you work direct cash transfers in scholarships, which is what they're doing to start with, scheduled caste, scheduled tribe scholarships, etc., makes sense if you can create the bank account, which they haven't and are not in a position to do. Getting that into food changes more than the mode of delivery, because the third factor comes in. Food prices and cash transfers are extremely vulnerable to inflation-led reduction of the value of that currency. So you're making cash transfers when rice might be costing, let's say the variety may be costing 15-20 rupees a kilogram. It doesn't actually. In urban India, all of us are paying, 40 rupees or this thing. So you're giving them a certain fixed amount of money. Is it price indexed? What happens when the price of grain goes up? It's never gone down, but I know, in India. What happens? Then the second thing is, the way the public, the entire sensible direction would have been for a universal public distribution system. Two things. Which are the countries where the direct cash transfers work? Those are countries with huge urban populations and much smaller rural populations. Even if you take a Brazil or this thing and you compare population below poverty line, population in rural areas, we are uniquely different from those countries. We have an overwhelming 70% rural population and a much larger poor population, which we keep trying to redefine in order to push it out of existence. So you're going to have that. In the public distribution system as it was originally envisaged, there was one more factor. When you make it universal, as in principle it was for decades, when you make it universal, the rich opt out by self-selection. Tata, Birla, you and I are not going to stand in the queue for 2 rupees rice. We're not going to do it. But when you're giving out cash, the percentage of people who will self-selection opt out, forget it. I'll be in that queue 2 times a day if I can. You're asking for such big trouble. You have not created the conditions for the cash transfer. If you get into food with it, then you're going to get into very serious trouble.
So this brings us very neatly into the question of corruption. The so-called anti-corruption movement, Anna Hazare's movement, got a lot of press. But this movement is solely focused on corruption of the government. Now, you've talked a lot about the imperfections in government policies and how they provide opportunities for corruption of middle people and others, but what would you say about the corruption problem generally in India and how it goes beyond
organs of the state? I would say that any anti-corruption movement will get a lot of good press as long as it's about governmental corruption or individual corruption and not about corporate corruption. And that is the built-in structural limitation of those movements, that they are very middle class and do not address the primary, largest, they don't address the elephant in the corrupt room, okay, which is corporate corruption. All our governmental corporate corruption is actually corporate-led corruption. Spectrum scam. Who got the money? Corporation. The ministers are corporations. Dayanidhi Maran is a corporation. He is a corporation, please. Okay, he is incorporated, he and his brother. Right. So, the corruption is corporation-led, but when they are caught, you are looking at them as ministers only. Now, you look at the media, even the most aggressive newspapers, you know, when the Colgate scandal came, there were two newspapers which are other, which I don't suspect, I don't question their financial integrity, those, that particular newspaper. It did not mention the word Reliance on the front page.
Can I just insert a few words about what Colgate is, because it's not a toothpaste?
Sorry.
Colgate was a scandal related to the giving out of licenses to mine coal, under corrupt conditions. So
mines are the property of the state.
Yeah, mines are the property of the state. So public assets were in effect being given away to private companies to mine coal, similarly to the Spectrum scan, without proper payments being made to the state.
Without tendering.
And then also without any subsequent provision for benefits to flow back to the people or the state.
And all the major corruption scandals, please note, the really giant ones, have not come out of media investigations. They've come out of governmental institutions. Whistleblowers in government and institutions like the Comptroller and Auditor General. An auditor who's done his work honestly. An official who has raised, who has blown the whistle. That's where most of the media have followed after the thing has come out. And have worked hard at making it look like the corruption of this minister or that minister. It's not corporate corruption. You play down the corporate side of it. And even more importantly, you play down the fact that it's not an aberration, that it flows out of the entire edifice of economic policy.
So in relation to Colgate, you were speaking about two newspapers which didn't mention the name of the company
Reliance.
That actually benefited. So they covered news of the scandal, but they didn't actually manage not to mention
the biggest actor
or the biggest beneficiary of the scandal.
Yeah. So you have this. And don't forget that the newspapers themselves are corporations. Okay. And a lot of people don't realize it, that the Indian English language newspapers in India, the top three are bigger than any of the English language newspapers in the United States. The Times of India's circulation is larger than the New York Times and Washington Post put together. Ken Auletta had a piece in the New Yorker in early October. You can look at it. It's got some of the numbers. I have problems with the piece, but it gives you some picture of the size and scale of what's going on. The newspapers are corporations. There are newspaper barons who are directly involved. The fourth biggest newspaper in the country is called Lokmat, a Marathi newspaper. Now look at it. Look at the convergence. I call this the new convergence. I would want to tell you what that means. The new convergence. Lokmat is the fourth largest newspaper or fifth largest newspaper. It keeps changing each year. The owner of Lokmat, Vijay Darda and his brother, one is a minister in the cabinet of Maharashtra, one is a member of the Raj Sabha in Delhi. They are huge owners, huge contractors in Colgate. They were allotted several blocks of coal, which as they assumed the role of subcontractors, having used their influence to get it, then sold it off at a huge profit, which is how the liberalization period in India has been moving. Central to that growth process has been the privatization of just about everything including intellect and soul. You know, 10 years ago, I used to be entertained and puzzled when I used to be introduced at meetings as an Indian public intellectual. I used to wonder what the heck that was. Today, I figured out that the rest of them have been privatized. So those of us who have not become owned by think tanks and whatever else, and those who are not owned by the government, we are the public intellectuals. They haven't found the right price yet, I guess. So I don't know. So you have the corruption is, I'm trying to say that it's not, the corruption is policy driven. It flows out of the kind of policies we have adopted. We have adopted a policy of indiscriminate, mindless deregulation and privatization. And look, that mindless deregulation has had spawned similar, if not identical, corruption scams in the United States, in every major country in the world. You've seen the same. So I'm saying it's policy driven. Let me put it this way. There's a small dip. You know, I have my own discipline of economics. I call it mechanomics. It tastes the same everywhere. McDonald's economics. There are eight or nine processes which are identical the worldwide. The first of these principles, you can look at it in Europe, you can look at it in USA, you can look at it wherever you want. In differing degrees, you will find that some of this happened. The first is the withdrawal of the state from sectors that matter to poor people. I'm arguing that the state has not withered away in the Marxian dream. The state is more interventionist than it has ever been, but it no longer mediates between different class interests. It is nakedly on the side of the corporate world, except when there are periods of turmoil, explosion, and then it has to try to save its own neck, balancing again. Second is the imposition of massive cuts in subsidies and life supports for issues that affect poor people, while increasing those for rich people. You have a brilliant example in the United States in the stories run by the New York Times last week about $90 billion in freebies for jobs that they never created or did not remain, though they were paid that money in order to retain those jobs. And you know what I thought when I read this? I thought, you guys are so primitive. Only 90 billion. We did 110 billion in our current budget. And that's just at the federal level. That's just at the federal level. You know, if you take the Indian budget, call it up on your screen if you like. Since 2007, every Indian budget has a section called, it's got an, what do you call those? Appendix or annexure. An annexure called Statement of Revenue Foregone. I love it, it's so honest, the title. You know, we're stating about the revenue we have foregone. Right. Now, if you look at the Statement of Revenue Foregone, on three heads, just three heads, there are about, I don't know how many hundreds of heads there are, but let's just take three. Direct corporate income tax, customs duties, excise duties. These primarily affect the super rich and the corporate world. And I'll explain to you how. Now, the direct corporate income tax write-off this year was already something like $10 billion or something like that in dollars. I'll have to find that for you. Okay, the write-off in the current one is on these three heads in the current budget. I call it plutocrat populism. It's, or you can call it corporate welfare or whatever, it's still the same loot. Roughly $100 billion write-off in the Statement of Revenue Foregone on corporate tax, excise and customs duties. These, the write-offs exceed the total budget deficit by $1.45 billion. I'm talking US dollars. The write-offs for the rich exceed the total budget. So the debate sounds a bit familiar, doesn't it, in the United States? Yeah, you're talking about the top 2%, we're talking about the top 0.1 or 0.01. Now, after much pressing on, actually a few people, some of us have been writing about this since 2006. Prabhat Patnaik has been writing about it since 92. This year, some very distinguished names got into the subject mercifully. Let me just tell you what was the biggest customs exemption after petroleum, which is the biggest import bill of any poor country. Okay, what is the single biggest customs anyone would like to guess what is the single biggest customs exemption, and then you will see whether it was for poor people or rich people or who it was. Anyone would like to guess? And I'll give you the amount. The last 2 years, the amount is $18.2 billion. What's the biggest? Anyone would like to guess? Gold, diamonds and jewelry. After petroleum, that's the biggest. Now, you know, those farmers who are committing suicide, those landless agriculture, they're not into gold and diamonds. They're not doing jewelry these days. Okay. So, you know where that money is going. You have these huge, and that's part principle four of mechanomics.
What was principle three?
One was withdrawal of the state.
Yeah.
Two was...
Imposition of cuts.
Yeah. Cuts. Third is the privatization of just about everything.
Okay.
Four is this rapid transfer of resources from poor to rich through these mechanisms. Hmm. And then there's five and six. The untrammeled or unresisted rise of corporate power anywhere in the world, almost. And with it, concomitantly, the rise of market fundamentalism, which is the ideology of that kind of corporate power. There is the suborning of local governance. You know, you create an elaborate system of local governance in India through the 73rd, 74th amendments, local governance, panchayati raj, village government, district government, you create these and then completely smash them when you need to take over lands for mining or for POSCO or wherever, then you completely suborn these governments. And by the way, in all these battles, the bulk of the media are on the side of the state and the corporate owners, arguing that this is what is necessary to get those people jobs. It's just that those people are such idiots, they can't see it. So you have a number of these principles which are more or less the same across the world. They're depressingly similar. That's why I call them McDonald's phenomenon. And so you have these kind of transfers, then resulting all these things that we have discussed till now, resulting, we didn't actually discuss the agrarian crisis itself, which is a highly complex thing, in the suicide deaths of over a quarter of a million farmers. Between 1995 and 2011, which is the period for which we have data from the government of India, the government of India's figures, which are highly doctored, highly massaged, are 271,000 farmers. And if I take those 17 years of data and divide it into two halves, of course you can't do an equal division because one is 9 years, one is 8 years. You will find in the second 8 years or 9 years, whichever way you choose to take it, the rate of suicides is much higher. In fact, it works out to one every 30 minutes, roughly, on average. That's one. The second thing is, part of the crisis in the countryside, we don't have the farm population totals for the 2011 census. We do not have that data yet. But we have the farm population totals for 91 to 2001. The number of people quitting farming between 91 and 2001 was 7.5 million. That means 2,000 farmers are quitting every day. By the way, again, those same guys who do that stupid migration data, they will tell you, no, the data shows us that the cultivators' numbers has actually gone up. And it has, because lots of poor women who weren't working earlier are now going and doing the drudgery of agricultural labor. But in the Indian census, there's a category called, apart from workers, it's got a category called main workers. Those who have done that work for 183 days or more, 6 months at least. These are your landed farmers. Those are the landed cultivators. That category has collapsed by 7.5 million. ultimately, what makes these farm suicides incredibly different from student suicides or housewife suicides or businessmen suicides is this. All those other populations are growing. And the suicides adjusted against the growth of the population are either the same, slightly higher in one or two years, or even lower when you adjust it for population. In farm suicides, farmers' suicides are going up, farmers' population base is coming down. When it's only when we get the 2011 farm totals will we know how much it has worsened, because the suicide ratios for the state of Maharashtra, I take four or five parameters, not just the ratio. A suicide ratio is number of farmers who commit suicide per 100,000 farmers population. Okay, that's one matrix. The other factor that I would take in is total number of suicides. One shouldn't get too caught up in the suicide ratios and percent. One has to use four, five factors. You see, if there are three farmers in Beverly Hills and one kills himself, then Beverly Hills is the worst place in the world to be a farmer, right? Because one third of all farmers have committed suicide in Beverly Hills. So you've got to have, what is the total farmer population? What is the total suicide ratio on that? What is the CAGR, your compounded annual growth rate? When you look at the CAGR of these different states, in Maharashtra, it argues that if the rate of suicides does not fall dramatically, the number will double in, say, 7 years. That's the kind of figures we
can. Sanath, I think I should probably open the floor up now to questions. You raise a lot of issues which are quite closely connected with one another. No one has yet said RTI, which some people may be very interested in. India has a very strong Right to Information Act, which was also thought at one time, thought of as another great anti-corruption measure. But that's not my question. I'm going to let people from the floor propose. But do try to keep your answers a bit brief,
okay,
because we would like to just hear from the room what your concerns and interests are sparked by what Sainath has said.
Ramesh?
Given this, I'm actually interested, this is really fascinating, but with the numbers and all that. Given this, I'm interested in just sort of the dynamics, the change in citizens' actions. Yeah, I mean, India's populations and the democratic space has allowed for protests and mobilizations of all kinds, from Maoists to the daily protest and so on. So I would be interested to know, given this situation, we know how the sort of urban population is reacting, if we take particularly the Anna Hazare movement around that and the media and so on. But how are they there for the rural? Is the space, I'm aware of the tension between during the Anna Hazare movement and the NAPM, which is sort of not only urban, not only rural, but urban as well. Just, I'd be interested to understand a little bit sort of more insights into, so given this, what's the sort of traditional democratic citizens' actions, or has that subsided? Has that changed the sort of anatomy of that?
In real terms, the number of protests by groups of people has gone up massively. Okay, these, in fact, what we were discussing before this meeting was, we are not able to view that dynamically, and we are not able to factor it into theory. The issue is, by the way, if you notice that I spoke for about an hour without using the word globalization, I don't think it explains very much of anything. Capitalism is good enough for me, right? Though globalization has its descriptive uses in some respects, but if you look at that, what the thing we call global, and it is global, the responses to those are increasingly and intensely local. It's about the privatization of water in your community. It's about the closing of the factory in yours. It's about the shutting down of the school in your neighborhood. And that's what, as long as we are looking for the big global action without trying to marry these energies we're missing the game is one thing that I'm saying. So that's one set of problems. The second is about how is the state reacting to these thousands of protests? It is reacting by increasingly criminalizing dissent. Now, I'm doing a series on that. It'll start coming from, say, about February. Let's take Kalinganagar. Now, increasingly the state has become an arm, the police or executive committee of the corporate world. So Tatas go to take land in Kalinganagar. There is a shooting and a firing. There is an Adivasi couple there, educated Adivasi couple with degrees from the University of Cuttack Until they ran into the Tatas, neither of them had ever been in a police station. Between them, husband and wife now have 91 criminal cases against them. They go to they live in the police station. Because every day they will be summoned back on something else. Their life is between courts, station, home. They will not be employed anywhere. Where employed, they're thrown out. So, and then, I've been speaking to a lot of policemen about false cases are not new to India, as you know, and nor are they new anywhere else in the world, including the United States and its McCarthy period and everything else. But as corporate dominance has grown worldwide in the last 10 years, that scale has exploded. The scale on which you criminalize people has become phenomenal. Two villages fighting against the South Korean steel major POSCO in Odisha. There isn't a child of 14 who hasn't got 10 cases on his head. And you should see the case now, as you said, there are different kinds of protests. There are Maoists. Now, one of the Maoist sympathizers who's in jail in Koraput in Odisha, I went to the jail to see him. One of the cases against him, he's a professor of chemistry. One of the cases against him is theft of a buffalo. The blighter wouldn't know what to do with that buffalo if you gave him a herd of them. Okay? He's as entertained by the charge as I was. I asked the inspector generals of police, why this? They say, see, we've been told by the government to keep these people quiet. Okay, if he comes out on one charge, you put him back on another. So he said, actually one inspector general used this word. He says, I need a creative mix of charges. Bailable, non-bailable. Offenses that you can get out on bail. He said, I need a creative mix of charges. So that will be on the one hand waging war against the state and on the other hand theft of a buffalo. Okay, so that's the response. And the protests are growing, many, many more little villages, and it's about resource battles. Real estate resource battles are the huge, huge thing. Yes, sir?
What are the causes, in your view, of the state's abandonment of the poor? How do you periodize this abandonment? How do you explain it? Say a bit more about the groups that are organizing opposition to this collusion between state and corporate interests. Are they political in expression? Are they mainly, are there unions? Oh, sorry, my name is Adam Schatz. I'm a journalist.
Okay. The thing, you know, it's a pretty complex thing. In fact, when people ask me why did farmers commit suicide in this period, when in the 60s and 70s, and that's a very valid question, farmers were staging militant uprisings to grab land reform, land distribution, and did it successfully. In West Bengal alone, 3 million acres of land were redistributed. Now this is for me the core question. In the 60s and 70s, for instance, we had mass movements. In the 90s and 2000s, we have mass suicides. Something happened, as you're suggesting, between these two periods was some transformation. My answer to that, everybody can have their own, is the complete transformation of the role of the state. The post-independent state in India still had some commitments to the poor. Remember, for 15, 20 years after independence, there was the pride of having liberated yourself as a nation, and the entire freedom struggle had been fought on certain commitments, which, by the way, for me, remain the way forward. You'll find them in a section of the Indian Constitution, which I believe is the beginning to a solution. It's called the Directive Principles of State Policy. I understand that if these are made, for me, if these are made a Bill of Rights, you're asking for a revolution in the country. And you have already made two of those into rights, like the right to education, for instance. Truncated it, but put it down on paper.
Can you explain more broadly what the directive is?
Yeah. There are two sections in the Indian Constitution concerning rights and responsibilities and stuff. One is the section that anyone familiar with any constitution knows, which are the fundamental rights of a citizen. Okay? Right to speech, assembly, all those things. I mean, broadly similar, because the Indian Constitution drew from many other constitutions of Europe, United States and elsewhere. The directive principles of state policy were different. They were about the vision of society that the founders had. Things that they felt that the government could not immediately provide, but had to, for instance, in the case of education, they said, free and compulsory for education for all within 10 years of the adoption of the constitution. It never happened. But that was the principle. One of the interesting things is that that principle has been, the earlier principles were strictly speaking not justiciable. But in recent years, Supreme Court has started making them justiciable, and there have been several spectacular rulings on that. Now, the directive principles are outline the responsibility of the state in looking after your health, your nutrition, your right to work, your right to education, your right to organize, all these. There are huge numbers of rights which are very, very real in the directive principles. Now, the governments have always taken the stand that these are not justiciable in a court of law, which is untrue, because the same one, there are a number of legal precedents on it, and two, the same clause in the Constitution says, while these principles at the introduction may not be enforceable in a court of law, they are fundamental to the governance of the nation and must inform economic and social policy formulated by government. That is, the Constitution enjoins that on government. So, in the 90s, the liberalization and privatization period, the government moves out of the sphere of the public and privileges the sphere of the private. India is much more developed as a capitalist formation than it was in 1947 or 1967. Corporate interests are much stronger and driving things. A transformation of the direction of the state takes place. The state is no longer an empire. It's an enforcer. And earlier, when the farmers fought, they had a chain of, maybe you call it a patronage chain, whatever, but they got some demands accepted. Now they get guns and false cases. So they've lost hope. There's a despair, a culture of despair growing in many poor people. And there is also a culture of militancy, as he said, many, many, many responses, not one.
Other question?
Fawzia, go ahead, and then maybe we can ask DC as well if there's any questions after. But Fawzia, go ahead.
If they have questions, go ahead. Maybe this is a little bit of magical thinking. Is there an opportunity to raise the issues you're raising much more frequently with the slowdown in the Indian economy? I mean, I felt over time that a couple of years ago, when you tried to address some of these fundamental flaws and questioned, you know, what kind of impact this had or what it meant for democracy, that you were basically shut down as, you don't get it, we're at 10% growth, you know, India is the, you know, going to be the next Disneyland, and et cetera, et cetera. But now with, you know, 5.5% growth, is there an opportunity for people like you, for us, to really highlight some of these fundamental issues that are emerging? And will we have more people listening and understanding and being more receptive to what needs to change?
Yes, in the sense, in a sense, and within certain parameters, yes. In the same sense, that while Occupy Wall Street and the Occupy movement generally did not lead to giant transformations, they opened a space where inequality is more discussed, is more embedded in the public discourse than it was 5-10 years ago. To that extent, yes. One shouldn't overestimate it though. I mean, 5.5% growth is, you know, still a number. The issue, the point I'm trying to say is that even if that growth was higher, it could be even worse. Because the nature of that growth is going to exacerbate the inequality. So it's not just a, but when it comes to 5.5, then the corporations and others are going to try maximizing their profits, making their world better by cracking down further on poor people. So they get shafted either way. So to that extent, yes. Certainly, when people are poor, I would say that post 2008, generally the climate in the world changed on the discussion of inequality. The Wall Street collapse meant a hell of a lot to opening spaces in that discussion worldwide. To that extent, yes. What do we do and what? How can we make us? Look, I am pretty optimistic about the mood of people and their willingness to resist. As I said, our inability comes up in being able to visualize and theorize a marriage of those energies out in the open area. We are not able to do that. We're looking for a single point of entry, you know, a global guardian knot. According to me, the unraveling has already begun and is halfway through. We need to start thinking about the raveling. I'll give you one figure. All of you are, given the kind of work you do, you're all familiar with the UN literature. Each year, UNDP puts out, and UN officials put out, you know, another $10 billion spent and everybody will have clean and potable water. Another $15 billion expenditure and extreme hunger will be eliminated. You know what I do every year? I sit and total it up. I've been doing this since 91, since UNDP has been doing it. It's grown from $35 billion to about $80 billion. In other words, $80 billion, and this goes back to his question also about the change. In $80 billion, the United Nations experts, such as they are, tell me that the basic problems of the world can be addressed seriously. I will not say solved. They say solved. Okay, but obviously, they can be addressed seriously. Now, the UNDP has been putting out these figures for 30 years, and it's never happened because governments say there's no money. Then Wall Street hits the fan. $80 billion. $1 trillion is available in 2 weeks. Another $8 trillion is put up in a few months. Suddenly there's no shortage of money to help. That's the difference when it was the popular need and the corporate need. You are living, in fact, I would describe the last 20 years, not as globalization, but as the period of the collapse of restraint on corporations. That has happened in the last 25 years. A complete collapse of restraint on corporate power. Right. So how is it that the governments of the world, which could not put up $80 billion for 30 years, it would have been half that amount had they done it in the 90s, could find $1.5 trillion in a month to save the world from itself, but basically to save the bankers? The money is there. I think what the kind of ferment that you're talking about, the kind of growing turmoil, to my mind, what the best thing it does is it makes people think about these issues.
In the West of Pakistan office. So, you know, there's a saying that you don't step in the same river twice, right? So, we can't go back to either the Fabian or socialist or communist ways of thinking in terms of the same categories, maybe. Humans of the 50s or 40s are very different from humans now. They've grown up in a very different era. So, how do you... And what it seems to be missing is that kind of theorizing which would create a different concept of a state given our recent history, a different concept of spaces and public versus private, individual versus non-individual, and ways of relating to each other, as say the Occupy Wall Street was trying to create new ways of relating between humans. Where is that kind of thinking going to come from?
See, I think the thinking is on. I don't see that we are managing to get the thinking together. Nothing ever, you know, a theory or an action or a course of action or a strategy, it's not, anyway, not yet something you can buy from Walmart, right, at reduced rate. It's something that evolves. I'm saying that we are in that period of turmoil where, you know, hopefully something will evolve, or will, I'm sure it will evolve. I'm sure for different people in different parts of the world, it is evolving. But let me take you back to one, the first part of your point. I'd say that things are a little curious. If you look at the Indian example, how we paint different periods, you know, is a game in historiography to justify what we do today. Like in Indian history, we know now that the 17th and 18th centuries were far more dynamic than historians painted them, because the British had to really make the Mughal period look hideous in order to justify the coming of colonial rule. Now, the point here is, it's very convenient to refer to what happened before 90s as socialism. There was no such thing in India. There was no social ownership of the means of production. There was one huge saving grace. There was a strong public sector. And that makes us very different from many of the Latin American economies that went into ruins. We had that. Today, we are privatizing that. One of our core strengths is being privatized. The second thing I want to tell you politically, actually, it's not just about people changing. It's about the incredible consistency of people. All the apologists of neoliberalism in India today, the older ones, these were all the guys who were the flag bearers of Nehruvian socialism. The guys like me who are attacking these guys are the guys who were attacking those guys. I find my enemies absolutely the same. It's hard to find a new one. Okay, I find that the same bunch of jokers in the cabinet, Narasimha Rao, the father of reforms, I knew him very well, he was from my home state, I shouldn't even admit to such horrible things, but the guy, he was the guy who drafted those Nehruvian socialist declarations for Mrs. Gandhi. He was her draftsman. The most ringing declarations of socialist intentions came from the fellow who is now recognized as the father of the reforms. Okay. That was a change that they made very comfortably to the new regime. Right? It was that Indian capitalism was changing dramatically. The world was changing dramatically. Part of what you call globalization is, in effect, the rich elites of the different countries seceding from their nations to inhabit a gilded global ghetto. Okay, so the rich have seceded from the nation, but now the rich want back a little bit of that, more of that nation, because the resources are running low. Otherwise, they could just do it with gated communities and everything else. Do you know, if you land in Hyderabad today or in Delhi today, and you're going towards Gurgaon, or you're going out of from the airport to Hyderabad, and in Pune, you'll find advertisements of builders extolling, "We give you a gated community." Okay, the rich have seceded. They're offering you a world shut out from all the great unwashed. That's what they're offering you. So there's been incredible consistency. Narasimha Rao was a minister in the cabinet who used to leak to us when I was a reporter, when I was working at a tabloid in Mumbai, and he came across with, he always gave the correct, appropriate, politically satisfying socialist jargon. We knew what he was and he knew what he was. In fact, when I wrote a very nasty thing after he went, then, who was it, Vasant Sate or one of these guys stopped me on the steps of parliament and said, "You know, you've been so insulting about Narasimha Rao ji. He's such a great linguist, he knew many languages, and he's a unique intellectual and a great linguist." I agreed. I went back and wrote that I totally agree. I never knew anyone else who had nothing to say in 9 languages. Okay. But a creature of the ruling regime. And that's what half your bureaucrats in charge of the thing are today. These were all guys who drafted socialist manifestos 20 years ago. There's great consistency. Theirs and mine.
Any questions from that end?
Hi, Mary Miller Flowers here with the Defendants' Rights Fund. And I guess just to bring it, the conversation maybe a little closer to some of our bread and butter, which is working on rights and working on human rights. I mean, India is known to have one of the best civil societies in the world, right? We go to places and work in places where there's absolutely nobody to fund. But that's not the case in India. India's got a vibrant civil society. And I know it's cliche, but the right to information movement is a really good example of it. So what, I guess the question would be, what do you see as civil society's sort of emerging role, or does there need to be a new strategy among civil society activists to begin pushing more strongly against some of these trends and tendencies that you're talking about? You know, we know the donors are part of the problem. There's not a lot of rights funding in India, which I think is also part of the Indian government's desire. But what is the role of civil society in holding to account the government to some of these major problems? Small question.
It's not. It's actually two very big questions. One is about the culture of rights itself. And I subscribe to that culture of rights, and that's why I said, for me, the single most important track or line, and I would strongly recommend you look at it, is the directive principles of state policy in the Constitution. You make that a Bill of Rights, you've got a revolution, no question about it. Because those who hold our entrenched privilege cannot accept that. And yet, it's a very great unifying ground. It was the outcome of a freedom struggle. It was the outcome of the founding of the Indian nation. Therefore, I say that that culture of rights is very important. Then you've got two more things, one about RTI and one about civil society. Let me confess that I often introduce myself as a representative of uncivil society, because I feel that that term itself has become a bit of a cliche and has become extremely elitist. I do not know many civil society bus drivers or nurses. I know a lot of human rights lawyers. That for me becomes civil society. To my mind, again, there's a certain Brahmanicalization of discourse. The experts capture the language. You know, when I see that civil society is driven by bus conductors, railway employees, agricultural laborers, I'll take that term much more seriously. But in terms of popular expression of resistance, yes, then yes, there are many things that are happening. And so I'm arguing that the term civil society as it applies today, certainly in India and to my mind in many places, is a very limited term. It's a very, very limited term. About the RTI and that, understand this, the RTI, yes, it was a great victory, you could say, of Indian civil society, correctly. It would not have passed, it had no chance, if there was not the biggest ever presence of the left in parliament. And if the United Progressive Alliance was not dependent on the left parties for the survival of its government at that stage. There were 64 members of the left in parliament. That's how the RTI Act passed. If they had 30 members or 25 members, the Congress would have said, we can't get this passed. Ultimately, it passed with a much bigger margin, but somebody had to move it in Parliament, right? So don't overlook underestimate the political importance of the importance of the political world in India as well. That is also a very dynamic world. That's a country where people change governments and change them frequently, okay? We haven't got into the choice that you have of, you know, two wings of the corporate party. We still have political movements that count to some extent. Shrinking, not anywhere what they should be, but they are there.
But was all the advocacy from civil society behind RTI by the left?
No,
certainly not.
I didn't say that at all.
Okay.
I never said. I said for it to become a law in Parliament, for it to become an act, it had to be passed there in Parliament. Just as now, when there were many things that would have happened differently, as they have now, when the left is on its knees, is no force, FDI in retail goes through Parliament. Okay? So, I'm saying please don't shut your eyes to the political sphere where there's an incredible amount happening. When the left was strong, FDI and retail never came up. It was never in the manifesto. They never allowed it in the joint declaration of the UPA. None of that ever happened, and they broke on the issue of nuclear power agreement or the nuclear deal with the USA because they said that was not in the common minimum program. Right. Likewise, FDI and retail was not in the common minimum program. It was not even in the Congress Party's manifesto. It's come now because the political sphere is fragmented and broken. So I'm saying that's also a very important thing. In the case of RTI, the political sphere, civil society got their act together. So the drafting, much of the preliminary drafting and serious drafting came from what you might call civil society. Though, by the way, the people who are part of that civil society, they prefer to describe themselves as a popular movement. Aruna Roy would prefer to describe her group, and she's a very good friend and one of the groups that I hold in the highest respect. They would prefer to describe themselves as a people's movement or a public action group than as civil society. So I was quibbling over the nomenclature. And I'm saying that even that had to have somebody in parliament to see that the bill was passed. Having said that, and having fully conceded your point about the importance of what you call civil society in the RTI, and I do concede that, it has had a tremendously positive effect in the last few years. In fact, this extent to which it has had a positive effect can be seen in the miserable index of the number of RTI activists who have been murdered, which keeps growing every year. The number of people getting killed for pursuing very powerful people and corporations in RTIs. So that itself is a measure of how seriously it's being taken. A lot of my work has been RTI related. I can never put my name on an RTI. My name goes into the ministry on an RTI, there's panic. So then they will call the lawyer and not the officer. But I use a lot of RTI through correspondence, I file it in other people's names and stuff like that. So I think that has been a significant achievement. That, and by the way, the Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme also came out of that combination of civil society activism and political. All those major bills were passed when that correlation of forces existed in parliament. All the negative things are happening when that correlation of forces in parliament has changed. Okay, civil society has not been able to stop anything on FDI in retail. Hasn't been able to do a thing. Even though it's got the middle classes on its side, and it's got a bit of the BJP's base on its side, trader base, the trader lobby of the main opposition party, even then they've not been able to do it. I'm saying the politics and the political sphere are also important. You get both together, you've got things happening. Can it happen? Yes. Will it happen? Tortuously.
So if I could just maybe paraphrase or recap what I hear you saying. Social and political change is possible, but it relies on a confluence of forces that is not properly understood.
And the third of those forces, which is the most important, is popular struggles, struggles.
Right. So I think there was some implicit criticism by you of the term civil society, which we use continuously in this building.
Explicit.
Okay. Thank you. As describing something, at least in the Indian context, which is inherently somewhat elitist, highly professional.
Beyond the Indian context.
Okay, beyond the Indian context. So civil society refers to people who are elite and are not going to, they may be good-hearted, but they won't change things on their own
be, and in several cases are wonderful people.
Yes.
And the question of their integrity and their intention is not
of effectiveness.
It's a question for me of exclusion. It's a question of exclusion. And India, so many of our problems are basically related to exclusion, whether caste is the biggest. But I'm saying there's a kind of intellectual exclusion of forces that are not part of a particular social circuit or a particular cultural political circuit. That is the point. That exclusion is what worries me. It means for me that civil society narrows itself down. It becomes the stomping ground of human rights activists, human rights lawyers, a couple of spectacularly successful activists. It becomes that. And the conferences and seminars reflect that character. Mm-hmm. I want to ask, where are the voices outside that which you can incorporate into civil society? As I said, are the nurses there? Are the bus conductors there? Mm-hmm. Are the agricultural laborers there? That's my question.
Yeah.
Why should civil society, when you think of civil society, who do you think of? Do you think of agricultural laborers?
No.
Yeah.
To be honest, I think of human rights lawyers.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably, I mean, of which I am party of the tribe. I think that probably, if we're taking away particular lessons for OSF's work as a whole, that's got to be an important element of our self-critique.
Broaden who you listen to.
Right. Well, and who we fund and partner with. But obviously that's challenging. The whole reason that these relationships grow up is that we already speak a language that we're comfortable with, and we're comfortable speaking with people who also speak that language. So it's not just for us to understand a particular situation, but understand how we're positioning ourselves in that situation. Any final questions?
I have one, but
yeah.
It may take from a different direction. Self-serving question.
Well, we understand that some people may have to leave, but officially we have another 15 minutes.
Okay,
so maybe I'll save some time for Sena to make final remarks.
One of the things that some of us are obsessed about is the new rapprochement between India and Pakistan, as far as it has gotten. But listening to you, if I do a mental scan of the room in which people appear to talk about Indo-Pak peace, it's exactly the same interest groups that you have described. It's the business elites, it's the military elites, it is the human rights world, it is generally the elites of both countries that come together to have discussions, and it is largely, what's largely absent is really the populations of two countries. Do you see that construct as a problem for the future, or do you see that as being okay for what we're trying to achieve in the region?
Let me put it this way, that more contact is better than less, always. Okay? More contact is better than less. That said, then we have to start sorting out the problems you're pointing to. One of those elites, by the way, which holds incredible power, is the national security elite.
Yes.
That is the thing that has a disproportionate level of power in both establishments and in most countries in the world. My understanding is, again and again, so I, within the contact that goes on, I'm very supportive of people-to-people contact. There are groups that try very hard, journalist to journalist, people to people. It gets very, very complicated. There are periods in the 80s or so when some of my friends were thrown into jail in Pakistan, and you can't say anything because then that guy will be branded as my agent. Okay, so it's got, I think we need to break that frame, and that frame I think we are capable of breaking. I think on both sides we are capable of breaking. So yes, so more contact, not less. Second, if you have more contact, what kind, what nature of contact? Then comes that competing thing between the corporate military elites on the one hand and people's movements on another. That, the nature of movements growing up on both sides does not allow for gigantic levels of optimism. Yeah? But I always feel that between exaggerated optimism and cynical pessimism, there's a territory you can call hope. Right? That I think is entirely legitimate.
Yes.
And for that, one can start doing that in a number of ways by taking up the most basic issues of ordinary people. Like, for instance, I'm saying, coming back to what you brought up at the very beginning of the discussion, I think the inequality levels should be the main staple of this debate. Take India. Today we are now fifth in the world in the number of dollar billionaires. We outrank and outgun any European country except Germany, and 3 years out of five we beat Germany in the Forbes list of billionaires. Okay? And the same country that is fifth in the dollar billionaires list is 134th in the UN Human Development Report Index. The same country that gets a value, an HDI value of 0.578 in the Human Development Index, the moment you apply, as the UN report does, you apply the inequality factor to it, our HDI, our miserable HDI, loses a further 30% in value. The current UNDP report, though it's not a good report, has brought in the gender inequality index and the inequality index. You apply the, so what happens? We are 134th in the HDI out of 187 nations. When the inequality is factored in, we lose 30%, we become 129 out of 146 nations, which is actually a serious worsening in the ranking. Apply the gender inequality index, which the UN report does, we are again 129 out of 147 nations. I'm saying the kind of inequality that has come up, and people feel it. We ought to be having that as a central point of argument, that the inequality, that the last time you saw these levels of inequality was under the colonial Raj. That's one. Second, take in India, the country which the fastest growing, you know, Asian tiger, and I love it that when we use the word tiger economy for an animal that's going extinct at a very fast rate. You know, you take with all that stuff, the government of India's Human Development Report, that is the Planning Commission, has brought out an India Development Report February this year. What does it show you? It says so in so many words. The rate of malnourishment amongst children below the age of 3 in India is almost double that of sub-Saharan Africa. I think that's an issue. I think that's something that you ought to be arguing about. In this situation, the government is getting out of provisioning of direct services to poor people, to hungry people. It will export that wheat. The public distribution system is dismantled. That is the eventual aim. They will start with the thin end of the wedge. So food will become an issue. And it's an interesting thing, and I wish I had remembered it when your colleagues from DC were there. One of the areas which has seen good activism in the last few years, serious activism, is the right to food movement. It's seen some very good activism. Okay? So there are really roti kapda makhan. Are issues. They really are issues on which you can mobilize people. In both countries, in Bangladesh, now I'm appalled that our civil society and our activists haven't been able to take up the Bangladesh garment issue and link it to Walmart's entry into India. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Although it's striking.
It is striking. It's begging to be heard in India. There you see the hostility of a very elite media. Look, the Indian Express on the 25th, or what was it, 84, on the 25th anniversary of Bhopal, wrote an edit saying, let's put all this nonsense behind us now. 500,000 people were affected, 20,000 died. Let's put this, Bhopal can be said to be rescued when it becomes the most favorable destination for international investors. Okay, so that's the attitude. That's the third thing, and I'm saying this whether in India, Pakistan or Bangladesh or in the United States. You cannot do a damn thing about anything we have discussed in our time, in our period, if you are not willing to confront corporate power. You know, Alexander Carey, the Australian political scientist or sociologist, he had a lovely saying which I think summed up an entire century in three sentences. He said, the 20th century saw three great events, three great developments, not events. I think it just about fits in everything. One, he said, the rise and growth of democracy. Two, the rise and growth of corporate power. And three, the rise and growth of corporate propaganda to stifle the rise and growth of democracy. I think it fairly covers the 20th century pretty well. Unfortunately, it's even truer of the 21st. Right? And again, a lot of people and activists, etc., are struggling with the ideas of, and again, there are exaggerated ideas of what, how to confront the media component of corporate power. You know, the kind of nonsense, exaggerated nonsense on Twitter and Google revolutions. Okay, in Tehran they had this revolution. You know how many? There were 60 Twitter accounts in Tehran. Big revolution. The Moldavian revolution. I don't think that Moldavia had 20 Twitter accounts. Arab Spring. You know, it's humiliating to me when I told that to the people of those countries, the amount of underground organizing that went on in Egypt, for instance. We are showing great contempt for the people of those countries who came on the streets by reducing their revolution to Google and Twitter, which at the first instance blocked the accounts of Assange and WikiLeaks. These are tools. They can add or enhance something. They do not make revolutions. So one of the questions we all need to confront is, in confronting corporate power, how do we confront the apparatus of corporate propaganda, of corporate media, the socialization process that takes place through the universities, through the media, through the theaters, through the television, through the internet also, by the way, if you look at the new data that's come out on this, the same seven suspects you will find dominate news on the internet and a lot else. And you will see all the, and you will see all the cultural, racial, ethnic and other divides, gender divides that you see in society, you will see that on the internet as well. And lastly, there is one thing that makes digital colonialism worse. It owns your personal data. Nobody else did that. So I'm saying, okay, let me not leave you depressed. As I always say, I'm absolutely convinced that things will get a lot better. But they get a lot worse before they get a lot better.
Okay. I don't think we could sum up better than that. Thank you, Saina.
Thank you.